readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and it's time to get a little CSI on. Channel your inner Magnum, call up your Steve McGarrett. This week, we'll be probing new titles of true crime. I shared before that I worked for a newspaper, the Miami Herald, for 15 years. I can tell you, without hesitation, that stories of true crime are often more unbelievable, have more twists and turns, and are much more compelling than anything a fiction writer could create. Just the facts, ma'am. Let's get this investigation underway.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
At the end of the 19th century, serial murderer Joseph Fouché, known and feared as the killer of little shepherds, terrorized the French countryside. He eluded authorities for years until he ran up against prosecutor Émile Forquet and Dr. Alexandre Lacassagne, the era's most renowned criminologist. The two men, intelligent and bold, typified the Belle Époque, a period of immense scientific achievement and fascination with science's promise to reveal the secrets of the human condition. With drama and in-depth detail, The Killer of Little Shepherds, a true crime story and the birth of forensic science, Douglas Starr revisits Fouché's infamous crime wave, interweaving the story of how Lacassagne and his colleagues were developing forensic science as we know it. We see one of the earliest uses of criminal profiling as Forquet painstakingly collects eyewitness accounts and constructs a map of Fouché's crimes. We follow the tense events leading to the murderer's arrest, and we witness the twists and turns of the trial, much celebrated in its day. In an attempt to disprove Fouché's defense by reason of insanity, Forquet recruits Lacassagne, who had revolutionized criminal science by refining the use of blood spatter evidence, systematizing autopsies, and doing groundbreaking research in psychology. His efforts led to a gripping courtroom revelation. Eric Davies narrates this fascinating mix of forensic science, narrative nonfiction, and criminal psychology.
Later that evening, he ardently proposed marriage. When he vowed that he would kill her if she ever betrayed him, she realized she had made a terrible mistake. In the weeks that followed, he pursued her relentlessly. Like other men who live easily with violence, Vache knew how to interweave threat, regret, self-pity, and charm in an attempt to prolong the relationship. Louise, who was a stranger to the town and worked as a housemaid, tried desperately to avoid him, inventing endless excuses for not being available. Once, taking pity as victims sometimes do, she agreed to meet him at a dance. They were standing awkwardly among the merrymakers when a soldier approached to talk to Louise. Vache lunged at the man with such fury that the soldier and Louise ran from the dance hall. Now she knew that she would never be safe in the same town as Vache. Too afraid to reject him directly, she made up a story that her mother had forbidden their marriage and had ordered her home. The distance did nothing to quell his obsession. He kept mailing her love letters. Finally, she responded in the clearest possible way. "It would be best if you stopped writing to me. Everything is finished between us. I do not want to go against the wishes of my mother, Furthermore, I do not love you. Adieu, Louise. She hoped that would finally end things between them. Besides, she knew that if he left his unit to find her, he would face charges of desertion. But her departure and final letter had sent him into such a series of rages that the regimental doctor diagnosed him as having nervous exhaustion and gave him a 4-month medical leave. He immediately headed to Baume-les-Dames, stopping to buy a revolver along the way. Any of the soldiers in Vacher's barracks would have told Louise not to get involved with the 23-year-old sergeant in the first place, for something wild and violent dwelled within him. They had witnessed his manias and explosive temper, how once, when a soldier lagged in formation, Vacher swiftly and without warning kicked him in the groin, or how, during alcohol-induced tantrums, he would hurl heavy wooden bureaus across the room, roar like an animal, and rip handfuls of hair out of his forearms. Another time, when he was passed over for promotion, he drank himself senseless, tore apart the barracks, and slashed with a razor at anyone who came near. He ended the episode by taking the blade to his own throat. After that incident, he was hospitalized and transferred to another company. Yet at times, Vacher could appear deferential and, when necessary, even charming. Undoubtedly, he behaved that way when he first met Louise, although under the stress of rejection, the beast had reemerged. Arriving in her village, he spent days trying to persuade her mother and family to accept him, only to succeed in frightening them as well. On the morning of June 25th, 1893, he went to the house of Louise's employer for a final confrontation before taking the train back to Besançon. Louise opened the door, recoiling when she saw him. "Why are you afraid, Louise?"
"I'm not afraid," she said unconvincingly.
"Look, I don't want to harm you. I've come here peacefully to demand the things that you owe me." He had become obsessed with reclaiming the letters and trinkets he had given her and the money he had spent taking her to dinner. She gave him all that he demanded, but still he kept talking about needing more. As he rattled on about his various resentments, she furtively backed her way up the marble stairway. The more he spoke, the more agitated he became. "When I think that you don't want me, Louise, we would have been so happy. Listen, you don't know what I am capable of doing. I've already told you, and I repeat, I'm crazy about you. Come away with me."
My next guest, Les Standiford, is the best-selling author of 20 books and novels, including the popular John Deal mystery series. His works of narrative history include The Man Who Invented Christmas, about Charles Dickens, and The Last Train to Paradise, the story of Henry Flagler. Les is the director of the Creative Writing Program at Florida International University in Miami. Now, with police detective Sergeant Joe Matthews, Standiford has written Bringing Adam Home, The Abduction That Changed America. It is the story of the infamous 1981 abduction and murder of 6-year-old Adam Walsh, a crime that has been called the most significant missing child case since the Lindbergh case. It went unsolved for 27 painful years. Adam's father, John Walsh, the host of America's Most Wanted, and his mother, Ruvay, have worked tirelessly for legislation to protect children. In 1982, the Missing Children's Act was passed. In 1984, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was established. And in 2003, the Amber Alert System was put into place. In 2006, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act was passed. Detective Sergeant Joe Matthews is a veteran homicide detective for the Miami Beach Police Department. He had been involved in the investigation of Adam's disappearance since the beginning. In 2006, Matthews was asked by the Walshes to once and for all identify their son's killer. The investigation would expose the bungles of the investigation by the Hollywood, Florida Police Department and its failure to bring the murderer to justice. Welcome, Les. It's wonderful to have you here with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Lane.
How did you meet Detective Sergeant Matthews and begin working on the book? How did you get started?
Almost by accident. I was on my way to catch an airplane on a book tour for The Man Who Invented Christmas, and Mitchell Kaplan called, Mitchell Kaplan of Books and Books here in Miami, and said, "I've got your next book. You've got to talk to this guy." I said, "Mitchell, I'm going to catch a plane." He said, "Take a half an hour and meet Joe Matthews," and thank God I did. That's what happened. That's how it was.
Yeah, we've had Mitchell as a guest, as in his role as one of the founders of the Miami International Book Fair. So how did Adam's story draw you in at this point in time?
Joe Matthews pointed out, he told me that there was going to be a big press conference. This was in early December of 2008. He said it was coming up in 10 days that they were going to announce the closing of the case of Adam Walsh after 27 years. And I said, "Why?" And he handed me, slid across the table, a big, thick report. And he said, "Well, the answer's in here. I finished up a 2.5-year investigation. The Hollywood police and the Broward District Attorney's Office reviewed it, and they have decided that we now know who kidnapped and killed Adam Walsh, and they're going to announce a press conference and call a press conference to announce that fact to the world."
How did Detective Matthews actually meet the Walshes? And I understand they asked him to look at the case again and finally find a resolution?
That's right. He had been on the case on loan from the Miami Beach Police Department from the very beginning. He was a polygraph expert and had seen how the case was going and tried to alert some of the superiors in the chain of command to what he thought was going wrong. And, of course, it was the old, "We don't need you. Go on back to your big city cop." And one way and another, over the course of 25 years, he kept being pulled back in and then kicked off the case. And in 2006, the Walshes had gone to Washington to lobby for the Adam Walsh Child Protection Act. And a reporter stood up and said, "Mr. and Mrs. Walsh, you're to be congratulated for all the fine work you've done on behalf of missing and endangered children. And Mr. Walsh, you've caught any number of heinous criminals as a result of America's Most Wanted. But tell me, does it ever bother you that in all this time you've been unable to find out who murdered your own son?" Well, it was Walsh managed to not to leap off the podium and strangle this guy. But afterwards, Mrs. Walsh said, "I'm sick of it. I don't want to hear that question ever again. If I have to hire a detective out of the Yellow Pages, I want someone to look into this and prove what we think we know." And John Walsh said, "Well, you don't have to hire anybody out of the Yellow Pages. There's Joe Matthews, who had gone to work after he retired in the 1990s as an investigator for America's Most Wanted, because they saw him for the competent cop he was over the course of years in trying to investigate their son's death." And Mrs. Walsh asked Joe to investigate the case. He agreed immediately, and, well, the result is why we're here today.
Can you give us some of the background of the detective? I mean, what was his personal history, his work?
He was a detective sergeant for the Miami Beach Police Department for 29 years and was really a super cop. He is the cop, the detective, who solved the Baby Lollipops case, probably the most heinous child murder in Dade history, and the case of Dieter Reichman, who was found guilty of murdering his wife, blaming it on rioters in Overtown at the time. And any number, he oversaw more than 2,000 murder investigations, so he knows the business, and he's got this energy. He's like the Energizer Bunny. Wind him up and just get out of the way, because he keeps going until he has got his man.
How involved were the Walshes in the writing of your book, or the preparation that you did to write the book?
Well, it really is not the Walsh's story as much as it is Joe Matthews' story. It's the story of how he managed to overcome all these obstacles all along the years. And, of course, the Walshes figure in, and they were quite cooperative. They'll be going out with Joe here in just a little bit to help promote the book. They're all for it. But really, it was a case of me sitting down with Joe Matthews and then with some of the case files and doing some ancillary interviews to tell his story and put it into a context so that people could appreciate the magnitude. It's more than just the story of a police procedural. This is a story about how a crime changed the world. You know, before Adam Walsh disappeared, there were no children on milk cartons, no Amber Alerts, no child database, no Center for Missing and Endangered Children. This case and the Walsh's efforts made all that happen. It has changed the world.
How did Detective Matthews close the case? I mean, if you can just share a little bit about that.
Well, he amassed a huge tapestry of work. It's not like television where a guy bends over a corpse with his magnifying glass and says, aha. But in fact, Joe went through 10,000 pages of case files and for the first time drew up a chronology of events and evidence gathered over the years that pointed toward one man, Otis Toole, as the culprit. And then the culmination was his discovery of a stack of photos that had languished moldering in a file for more than a quarter of a century. No one had ever developed these this photographic blood evidence that more or less proves, without beyond a shadow of a doubt, what happened. I can't describe it as fully as they say. You got to read the book.
You got to read the book. And the 27 years, I mean, was it just incompetence from the police department in Hollywood, Florida, or?
Well, it was. It was a small town department in over its head. The lead detective, in Joe's opinion, made some pretty serious mistakes, and his immediate coterie made some pretty serious mistakes there at the outset that sent them off down the wrong track, and it's very hard to come back. They weren't willing to come back. Superiors, after a while, began to cover up what they recognized as mistakes, and then finally it became indifference. It had happened so long ago, the attitude was, oh, Walsh's, go away. You've got other children. You're famous. Please leave us alone. Until Chad Wagner came along at Hollywood, now the chief, and said, you know, we do need to take another look at this. And that made all the difference.
Well, on a totally different topic, your university just received a major grant from the Knight Foundation for creative writing. Can you tell us about that and how it's going to impact your work there?
Well, I think that's terrific. The Knight Foundation is that to get something from them really is a badge of honor. Campbell McGrath, my colleague, was instrumental in making it happen. And it really does put the university and the program out there in a way that never has been before. Specifically, it's going to allow us to bring in some of the very best and brightest that we literally might not have the funds to support otherwise. So we're really excited about this. We think it's going to make a big difference, and we're going to bring some interesting people down to the program and to Miami.
Back to the book for one moment. Are you going on a book tour, and if so, what cities?
We're going to Washington, D.C. We're going to New York City. We're going to be in Charlotte, Jackson, Mississippi, Oxford, Mississippi, Blytheville, Arkansas, Memphis, all around Florida. We're going to be on the Today Show, Nightline, The View, many more.
Okay.
USA Today is doing a feature, and you name it.
We will look for it. Thanks so much for being here today,
My
Les.
Pleasure. Thank
Alrighty.
You.
Bye.
She fought the surge of panic that every mother feels when she turns and finds her child suddenly lost from sight. The ripples on the surface of the nearby pond are all menace. The sounds of distant traffic suggest catastrophe and grief and guilt. But she would not panic foolishly, this mother. She would retrace her steps. She would have the store announce her son's name, and that he should find a clerk and report himself. While store personnel stood ready, she would return to the place she had left her car. He would be waiting there, or he would come to her, or she would find him. She would not panic. She would find her son. Surely, she would find her son. Washington, D.C., February 13th, 2006. At a Capitol Hill press conference, a reporter stood to ask a final question of John Walsh, leading proponent for the about-to-be-debated Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. Walsh, a private citizen, had become perhaps America's most recognizable crime fighter, owing to his work as executive producer and host of the long-running television program America's Most Wanted. But also, in the wake of the 1981 kidnapping and murder of his son Adam, he and his wife, Revee, had dedicated much of their lives' energies to raising awareness of the problem and the plight of missing children in America. As a result of the Walsh's work had come the passage of the 1982 Missing Children Act, the establishment of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in 1984, and the National Amber Alert Program of 2003. Walsh considered the new bill that was about to go before Congress the capstone of a life's work, removing impediments to the recovery of the nearly 800,000 children who are reported missing in the United States each year. "Mr. Walsh," the reporter began, "you've done much good work on behalf of children and families everywhere, and you've brought any number of heinous criminals to justice with your television show. But I'm wondering if it ever bothers you that you have been unable, in all these years, to find out who killed your own son." It was a question asked out of ignorance, the sort of thing that made several in the room wince. Walsh managed to respond without losing his composure. But following the incident, he and Revee contacted longtime associate and America's Most Wanted investigator Joe Matthews to set up a meeting that would prove to be momentous. As a veteran homicide detective for the Miami Beach Police Department, Matthews had supervised and conducted more than 20,000 criminal investigations and over 2,000 death and homicide investigations, and had obtained confessions and convictions in a number of high-profile cases, including Miami's infamous Baby Lollipops torture murder, that of Washington State's spree killer Chad Daniel Roberts, and Canada's University of Waterloo serial rapist Christopher Meyer. But more important, Matthews, a widely recognized polygraph expert, had been involved in the investigation of Adam Walsh's disappearance and murder from the very beginning, 25 years before. His skill and tireless efforts to bring mistakes and overlooked evidence to the attention of those in charge of that still unresolved investigation had earned him the respect and the friendship of the Walshes over the years. And following his retirement from the Miami Beach Force, Matthews had gone to work as a lead investigator for America's Most Wanted, where he was quickly credited with solving the program's first cold case investigation, the killing of a former high school wrestling champ by four football players at Lock Haven University in Pennsylvania. Matthews was well aware that for all the good work that the Walshes had accomplished over the years, there still existed a great void in their lives. Adam was gone, and though both they and he had expended vast resources and energy trying to do what the authorities had been unable to do, the person responsible had never been brought to justice. And for all the effrontery of the reporter's question, it was scarcely the first time it had been asked. The Walshes had been asking virtually the same thing of themselves, if only privately, nearly every day for a quarter century. On this day, however, Matthews could see that something different had taken over the Walshes' demeanor. Perhaps it was the pain of such a jab coming in the context of seeming triumph with the passage of the Child Protection and Safety Act.
In 1911, two wealthy British heiresses, Claire and Dora Williamson, came to a sanatorium in the forests of the Pacific Northwest to undergo the revolutionary fasting treatment of Dr. Linda Burfield Hazard. It was supposed to be a holiday for the two sisters, but within a month of arriving at what the locals called Starvation Heights, the women had become emaciated shadows of their former selves. They were not the first victims of Linda Hazard, a quack doctor of extraordinary evil and greed who stopped at nothing short of murder to achieve her ambitions. As their jewelry disappeared and forged bank drafts began transferring their wealth to Hazard's accounts, Dora Williamson sent a last desperate plea to a friend in Australia, begging her to save them from the brutal treatments and lonely isolation of Starvation Heights. In this story, Starvation Heights, a true story of murder and malice in the woods of the Pacific Northwest, author Greg Olson reveals an extremely unusual and disturbing criminal case. Michael Connelly comments, a fascinating turn-of-the-century story of medical malpractice and murder. If you like The Alienist, you'll find Starvation Heights all the more gripping because this story is true. Narrator Jennifer Van Dyke adds color and depth to the tale.
The list was astonishing in its breadth. Cancer, toothache, psoriasis, heart trouble, tuberculosis, epilepsy, insanity, all had been cured by the fasting specialist from Seattle. In the annals of medicine, her followers would assert, had there ever been a doctor with such a remarkable record of success? The woman who stood alone among all others was not one to deny herself an opportunity to recite her achievements. She did so frequently, before new patients, family members, civic groups, and the newspapermen who dogged her for interviews whenever her name made the papers. When Linda Burfield Hazard recounted tales of her patients and their remarkable recoveries, she spoke with an ear-ringing voice and presence so commanding that be it before a group of 100 or 2, there would be no others in the room. Dr. Hazard lectured with a kind of conviction usually reserved for the clergy. And, in an odd sense, that was what she was. She was a believer in the new gospel of good health. Science bore it out. Dr. Hazard was a missionary of medicine. One case she frequently recalled was that of Mrs. J.B. Barnett, a 65-year-old woman from Kansas City, Missouri. In many ways, it was typical of the doctor's medical epics. Mrs. Barnett had never been well, suffered from chronic constipation and aggravated bilious attacks. Until she undertook the fasting treatment, she was afflicted with an unshakable and debilitating melancholia, resulting in mild suicidal tendencies. She had been a burden to her family for years. The doctor outlined the treatment. On arrival, the two-meal regime was immediately begun on the strict vegetarian basis that the treatment is based upon, and, by the way, the patient had been an enormous meat-eater. Meat-eater was a term the doctor used with considerable and unbridled disdain. She said the phrase sharply, a bit louder than the other words, and with a slight knowing shake of the head. Meat-eaters are foolish, disgusting, suicidal. After a week of this, one meal was dropped, and the daily repast fixed at the regular 6 o'clock dinner hour of my family. She began also to have the foulest discharges from the bowels, and each enema brought away quantities of old fecal matter with quantities of bile, blackish in color. At this point, listeners would usually shift uncomfortably in their seats. Linda Hazard was a doctor, but her candor was unsettling, if not a little too descriptive, for such a private concern. A few days of this, and the meal was cut down to a little fruit. The last solid food given was a bowl of lima bean broth, after which the patient went 48 days until any solid food again was given, of which 45 days were absolute fast. I call this bean broth a solid food, for it is a great strength giver, and is my standby in many instances when breaking a fast. The fast developed no unusual symptoms, except that the discharges were continually foul and very black. Very black, very foul. During the whole time Mrs. Barnett was able to be about the house, and when elimination finally gained the day and her vitality began to increase, the old lady did lots of work that served to keep her occupied and content. From the second week of dieting, the mental state showed improvement. At the third week, the patient sat down of her own accord and wrote a long, cheerful, rational letter to her daughter, a thing she had not done in 4 years. The little household duties that she performed were things that she could not do, and showed no desire to do in all the history of her loss of mental power. And from the fourth week of her fast, this desire was present, and she was able to have it gratified as her strength returned. Hunger manifested itself about the 43rd day, and the tongue showed clean on the 44th. But we waited until the morning of the 46th before feeding a small bowl of diluted bean broth, which tasted like the nectar to a system renewed, as it seemed to her own people, miraculously.
On Mother's Day night, 2004, award-winning fourth-grade teacher Nancy Seaman left the Tudor home she shared with her husband of 32 years in Detroit's gated community of Farmington Hills. She drove in a driving rainstorm to Home Depot to purchase a hatchet. 3 days later, police discovered the mutilated body of Bob Seaman, a successful auto industry engineer, softball coach, and passionate collector of vintage Mustangs. His body was in the back of the family's Ford Explorer. As the shackles were placed on her wrists, Nancy Seaman asserted her husband had been beating her and she killed him in self-defense. At her trial, two radically different stories emerged. This is the story of Internal Combustion, the story of marriage and murder in the Motor City by George Maynard. One of the couple's sons, Greg, testified his father had been abusing his mother for years. The other, Jeff, testified for the prosecution, charging his mother with a cold-blooded killer. Joyce Maynard's chilling work delves beyond the events of the crime itself and explores the lives of an American family who seemed to have everything. As the author continues to investigate, we meet a Transylvanian forensic pathologist, a beautiful young prosecutor, an old-school police chief, a TV news crew hungry for ratings, and a softball scorekeeper mom accused of carrying on an affair with the murdered man. The book is read by Janet Ivey.
I was sipping coffee and eating a grapefruit at my kitchen counter at the time I heard the news report. There was plenty of interest there. But what caught my attention more than anything else was the reference to the sons of Nancy Seaman, two brothers who had taken opposing sides in a murder in which one of their parents had been the victim, the other the accused. As it happens, I am a mother of two sons close to the ages of Jeff and Greg Seaman. Mine were also children of a troubled marriage, trouble taking many forms, as it does. But unlike Bob and Nancy Seaman, who had stayed so long entangled, with neither one willing to let go of the rope, my children's father and I had parted when they were small. For them, unlike the Seaman brothers, there had been no source of comfort or strength more sustaining than each other's presence. The idea of two brothers, 2 years apart like my sons, but divided so deeply and with so much bitterness that they might never find their way back to each other, struck me as a particularly poignant and terrible situation. All the more so because the very events that divided them, their father's murder, their mother's incarceration and trial, should have driven them to find solace with each other. So here was this woman, almost exactly my age, 51, on trial for murder in the state of Michigan. Just a few miles, I noted, from the equally privileged suburb where my children's father had grown up, though I told myself this was not a factor in my interest. To look at us, Nancy Seaman and me, you would not have identified any particular source of common ground or kinship, but there was this. Her marriage, like mine, had broken down irretrievably, leaving two sons, also a daughter in my case, to witness the sad spectacle. The part about the breakdown of a marriage I knew, and 16 years after my divorce, I continued to carry it around with me, a wound that still gave me trouble, like an injury from a car wreck that causes the once broken bone to ache on rainy days, or a piece of music you hear on the radio for the first time in a decade that brings tears to your eyes. Irreconcilable differences.
In Too Late to Say Goodbye, Anne Rule, one of America's top true crime writers, offers a riveting real-life drama, a heartbreaking story of treachery, jealousy, and murder. Jen Corbin appeared to have it all. Two sweet little boys, a posh home in one of Atlanta's upscale suburbs, expensive cars, a plush houseboat, and a husband, Dr. Bart Corbin, a successful dentist who was tall, handsome, and brilliant. But gradually, their seemingly idyllic life began to crumble. Bert was distraught, and Jen seemed disenchanted. Then, a few weeks before Christmas 2004, Jen was found dead with a bullet in her head, an apparent suicide. But Detective Marcus Head was not totally convinced, nor was Jen's family. Was this death related to another apparent suicide 14 years earlier? Or was the answer to be found in the secret, even dangerous relationship Jen Corbin was having outside her marriage? Anne Rule interviewed virtually everyone related to the story to uncover the truth behind the headlines of these two sensational deaths. What emerges is an incredible tale of jealous rage that runs from the steamy to the macabre. Barbara Caruso narrates.
The current Gwinnett County District Attorney, Danny Porter, was once one of those assistant DAs. By 2006, after four terms as the district attorney, Porter had a staff of 90, including 34 lawyers and 23 investigators. In 1990, the historic red brick courthouse in Lawrenceville was bursting at the seams. The new $72 million Gwinnett County Justice and Administration Center on Langley Road opened in 1991. The modern structure with 22 courtrooms featured polished steel banisters, etched glass walls and dividers, polished parquet floors, and skylights, where the drum of a hard rain was almost louder than thunder. It was an expansive complex, yet it too soon began to strain against its walls. In the district attorney's office, a law library had to be sacrificed to make more office space. Small cubicles were made even smaller and arranged in what became a challenging maze for the uninitiated. The visitor's parking lot was the site of a very large monument dedicated to America's sons and daughters who served honorably in the armed forces. The 61 acres around the Justice Center were landscaped with chinaberry trees, pin oaks, crepe myrtles, lilies and begonias, azaleas and holly. Both the front and rear entrances were welcoming, but just inside those doors were the guards and metal detectors that have become ubiquitous in courthouses and law enforcement structures across America. For some who came to this building in Lawrenceville, Georgia, there would be justice and triumph, and for others, heartbreak. Part 1. Jennifer Barber Corbin. Jen. Chapter 1. December 4th, 2004. The shriek of sirens piercing the chill December morning on Bogan Gates Drive was almost as alien as the thackety-thackety of helicopters overhead would be. This quiet street in Buford is a relatively new part of an upscale neighborhood, home to young and middle-aged professionals and their families. The houses here have mostly red brick facades with glossy black shutters, not unlike homes in Atlanta's more affluent districts, but on a smaller scale. In 2004, the average price of a home in Bogan Gates was between $200,000 and $300,000. The homes would cost twice that in Denver or Seattle or Philadelphia. Buford is an ideal suburb for those who commute the 35 miles to Atlanta. Large enough with over 14,000 residents to merit local shopping centers, but small enough to dissolve the tension that comes with driving the I-285 beltway that encircles Atlanta with bumper-to-bumper traffic. And Bogan Gates Drive itself is an oasis of serenity, with its manicured lawns and colorful gardens. Children play under the watchful eyes of all the adults there. If some stranger should insinuate himself into this enclave, he would not go unnoticed. A negative note, at least for some, is that close neighbors tend to know each other's secrets. There isn't the anonymity that exists in apartment buildings in large cities. Neither is there the loneliness that city dwellers sometimes feel. Even so, some families on the street have secrets that none of their neighbors could possibly imagine. That doesn't stamp Bogan Gates as different. Every community has its mysteries, and even its surprising secrets. When reporters for television news and local papers sweep into such places, they are certain to obtain instant interviews with shocked residents who invariably say, "Something like that just doesn't happen here, not in our neighborhood." But of course, it does. On this day, in early December, Bogan Gates Drive just happened to be the site of one of the most horrific crimes in Georgia. The town of Buford, its name as southern as a name can be, sits close to Lake Lanier. This popular vacation spot's waters meander for mile after mile, cutting channels deep and wide into the shoreline, leaving inlets that resemble the bite marks of a giant alligator.
fans of the award-winning musical Chicago will find plenty to like in The Girls of Murder City by Douglas Perry. This is a nonfiction look at the women who inspired the play and the movie Chicago, and it gives plenty of salacious behind-the-scenes detail about the murder trials that fascinated a city and a nation. There was nothing surprising about men turning up dead in Chicago in 1924. Life was cheaper than a quart of illicit gin in the gangland capital of the world. But two murders that spring were special, or so Maureen Watkins, a wannabe playwright and a girl reporter for the Chicago Tribune, believed. Newspaper women were supposed to be writing about clubs, cooking, and clothes. But the intrepid Miss Watkins, a small-town minister's daughter, zeroed in on murderers instead. Her editor made the most of her sweet temper and sympathetic looks, dispatching her for quotes and interviews other reporters just could not get, and it paid off. Watkins would make stylish Belva Gardner and beautiful Beulah Annan, both of whom had brazenly shot down their lovers, she made them the talk of the town. Love-struck men sent flowers to the jail, and newly emancipated women sent impassioned letters to the newspapers. Soon, more than a dozen women preened and strutted on Murderess's Row as they awaited their trial. Watkins' front-page stories were must-reads, filled with her own voice and style. She turned their story into a play called Chicago in 1926, and in doing so, she immortalized Gardner and Annan as Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly. Perry weaves old newspaper articles, research, quotes, and commentary into a story about our own obsession with celebrity murderers while incorporating the biggest issues of the jazz age, prohibition and the rise of feminism. Narrator Peter Bearcrutt easily shifts from facts to scandal. Let's listen.
Solid, reliable William Gardner, the millionaire scientist and businessman who had provided her with lawyers and was determined to marry her again, despite her newly proven skill with a revolver. He believed Belva had changed. Maybe she had. But either way, she was still quite different from the other girls at the jail. She came from better stock, and made sure they all knew it. Even an inmate as ferocious as Catherine Malm, the wolf woman, deferred to Belva. Class was a powerful thing. It triggered an instinctive obeisance from women accustomed to coming through the service entrance, or in this lot's case, through the smashed-in window. Belva, it seemed, had just the right measure of contempt in her face to cow anybody, including unrepentant murderesses. She was not beautiful like perfect young Beulah Annan. Her face was a sad, ill-conceived thing, all the features slightly out of proper proportion. But arrogant eyes shined out from it, and there was that full, passionate mouth, a mouth that could inspire a reckless hunger in the most happily married man. She'd proved that many times over. When Belva woke from her blackout on the morning of March 12th, new to the jail, still wearing her blood-spattered slip, she'd wanly asked for food. The wolf woman, supposedly the tough girl of the women's quarters, hurried to bring her a currant bun.
"Here, Mrs. Gardner," she'd said with a welcoming smile, eyes crinkled in understanding. "Eat this and pretend it's chicken. It makes it easy to swallow."
With that, Catherine Malm set the tone. By the end of the week, the other girls were vying for the privilege of making Belva's bed and washing her clothes. To her credit, Belva adapted easily to her new surroundings. The lack of privacy didn't seem to bother her. The women's section of the jail, an L-shaped nook on the fourth floor of a massive, rotting, rat-infested facility downtown, was crowded even before her arrival, and not just because of the presence of Mrs. Anna Piculine. Big Anna, the press said, was the largest woman ever jailed on a murder charge. She'd killed her husband when he said he'd prefer a slimmer woman. Then there was Mrs. Elizabeth Unkoffer, charged with murdering her lover after her cuckolded husband collapsed in grief at learning of her infidelity. And Mary Wiesenack, Moonshine Mary, the first woman to be tried in Cook County for selling poisonous whiskey. Nearly a dozen others also bunked on what was now being called Murderess's Row, and more were sure to come. Women in the city seemed to have gone mad. They'd become dangerous, especially to their husbands and boyfriends. After the police had trundled Beulah into jail, the director of the Chicago Crime Commission felt compelled to publicly dismiss the recent rash of killings by women. The ladies of Cook County, he said, were just bunching their hits at this time. He insisted there was nothing to worry about. The newspapers certainly weren't worried. They celebrated the crowded conditions on Murderers' Row. Everyone in the city wanted to read about the fairest killers in the land. These women embodied the city's wild, rebellious side, a side that appeared to be on the verge of overwhelming everything else. Chicago in the spring of 1924 was something new, a city for the future. It thrived like nowhere else. Evidence of the post-war depression of 1920 to 21 couldn't be found anywhere. The city pulsed with industrial development. Factories operated 24 hours a day. Empty lots turned into whole neighborhoods almost overnight. Motor cars were so plentiful that Michigan Avenue traffic backed up daily more than half a mile to the Chicago River. And yet this exciting, prosperous city terrified many observers. Chicago took its cultural obsessions to extremes, from jazz to politics to architecture. Most of all, in the midst of Prohibition, the city reveled in its contempt for the law.
From its inception, Atlantic City has always been a town dedicated to the fast buck. In Boardwalk Empire, The Birth, High Times, and Corruption of Atlantic City by Nelson Johnson, readers are offered a wide-reaching history and riveting account of its past 100 years, from the city's heyday as a Prohibition-era mecca of lawlessness to its rebirth as a legitimate casino resort town. Johnson shows how Atlantic City was one of the cradles of the American Mafia, as it served as an entry point to those wanting to get around Prohibition, including a young Al Capone. And overseeing it all was the archetypal character of Enoch Nucky Johnson, half politician, half underworld boss. His career personified the greed, the corruption, and the high times of Atlantic City in its glory days. His ties with the Republican Party and invitations to the White House were a case study in official corruption. The title is wonderfully narrated by Joe Montagna, and it is the true story that inspired Martin Scorsese's series for HBO.
For nearly 30 years, Enoch Nucky Johnson lived the life of a decadent monarch, with the power to satisfy his every want. Tall, 6'4", trim and broad-shouldered, Nucky Johnson was a ruggedly handsome man with large, powerful hands, a glistening bald head, a devilish grin, friendly gray eyes, and a booming voice. In his prime, he strode the boardwalk in evening clothes complete with spats, patent leather shoes, a walking stick, and a red carnation in his lapel. Nucky rode around town in a chauffeur-driven powder-blue Rolls-Royce limousine, maintained several residences, hosted lavish parties for hundreds of guests, used the local police as his private gendarmes, had a retinue of servants to satisfy his every want, and an untaxed income of more than $500,000 per year. His antics were reported widely, and at the height of his reign, he was a national phenomenon, hailed as the Tsar of the Ritz. Despite his notoriety, Johnson was a product of Atlantic City who couldn't have flourished anywhere else. Enoch Lewis Johnson was born on January 20, 1883, in Smithville, a small bayside farming village several miles north of Atlantic City. The son of Coonley ally Sheriff Smith Johnson, Nucky spent his childhood moving between Atlantic City and Mays Landing, according to his father's rotation as sheriff. During the years as sheriff, Johnson and his family lived in the sheriff's residence next to the county jail. The years as under-sheriff, the Johnsons lived in a rambling frame home in the resort, so the sheriff and his wife could enjoy the social life of a booming vacation center. Nucky's parents, Smith and Virginia Johnson, had used politics to escape the backbreaking work of farming. Election to sheriff was the ticket to an easy life and status in the growing resort. Smith Johnson was a broad-chested bear of a man with a thick black mustache. Standing 6'2", weighing 250 pounds, and having paws for hands, he had the strength to lift a wagon. No one ever gave Sheriff Johnson a hard time. Virginia was a tall, slender, beautiful woman with long auburn hair and hands with fingers meant to play the piano. She was always exquisitely dressed and was the kind of woman that comes to mind when you think of an elegant Victorian lady. Virginia was every bit the politician in her own right. She was big on charity, organizing fundraisers and whatnot for the poor people, but she always made sure they knew the help came from the Republican Party. Through his parents, Nucky was immersed in politics long before he was old enough to vote. As a child and a young man, Nucky watched his father make a plaything of government. The law forbidding the re-election of a sheriff was supposed to prevent an individual from accumulating too much power, but the cozy relationship between Smith Johnson and Sam Kirby made a mockery of the re-election ban contained in the state constitution. The sheriff's employees were handpicked solely on the basis of patronage, and the fees his office collected were reviewed by no one. Smith Johnson's tactics and the success he attained taught his son early on that government and the electoral process was no more than a game to be mastered for personal power. Nucky also learned that in Atlantic City, a politician would only have power so long as he was prepared to bend the laws when needed to help the resort's economy. Smith Johnson and Lewis Coonley were close friends, and the sheriff's favorite hangout was the Commodore's Hotel. There were many evenings when, while still a boy, Nucky sat quietly next to his father at the corner and listened to the stories and strategies of Coonley and his cohorts. Coonley's Hotel was the hub of Republican politics in Atlantic City and the place where important political decisions were made. Nucky may not have understood all he heard, but he was there, and while still in his teens, began to learn the rules of the game. By age 19, Johnson made his first political speech, and as soon as he was old enough to vote at age 21, his father appointed him under-sheriff. He completed high school, attending a year at a teacher's college, and put in a stint at reading law in the office of a local attorney, but it was politics he wanted.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
In November 1970, Charles Manson was sentenced to death for the cold-blooded murders of seven people near Los Angeles. His sentence was later reduced to life imprisonment after California abolished the death penalty. At Manson's trial, he was portrayed as a demonic cult leader who hypnotized people to commit murder. The lead prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, published his theory in Helter Skelter, one of the most popular true crime books of all time. When author Marlon Marinick was 8 years old, he discovered a beat-up copy of Helter Skelter. The book's portrayal of Charles Manson as an icon of unbridled evil haunted Marinick for years, well into his career as a psychiatric nurse. So when a chance conversation with a man selling Manson memorabilia on the internet facilitated a connection to Manson himself, Marinick went along for the ride. This happenstance journey introduced Marinick to Manson's closest confidants, eager to share his story, his passion, and his philosophy. The adventure escalated with Marinick's phone conversations with Manson and ultimately crescendoed when the two met behind tightly locked doors of California's Corcoran State Prison. Charles Manson now is a critical dissection of what happened 41 years ago when Manson family members stormed the Polanski estate and committed the most heinous murders. The book also features samplings of Manson's own writing and a poetic, ironic, and disturbing account of his universe, from his childhood to his time in the 8x12 prison cell where he is condemned to stay forever. Readers will hear Charles Manson uncensored, unedited, and in his own words. The book is narrated by Al Gravel.
I'd been sucked into a whirlwind. Over the next few weeks, I talked to Manson several times, although he never actually called me himself. Kenny would dial my number and quickly press the receiver into Manson's hands. I'd believed and continue to believe that Charles Manson is one of the most complex characters that ever lived. And though it could take several lifetimes to understand fully both the depth and distortion of his thoughts, it takes only an instant to become completely immersed in his delivery. Charles is a natural storyteller, and his voice ebbs and flows according to his own unique inventions in rhythm and rhyme. He is lyrical. His words lilt and form both verse and chorus. He snarls and growls. He is often breathless with enthusiasm. He speaks of himself in the third person. During a typical phone call, an occasional howl will escape from the mysterious backdrop of the Corcoran PHU and flood the phone line, but Manson is never fazed. When we talked, Manson was sometimes engaging, sometimes defiant, sometimes both. He would be funny, candid, even vulnerable. And he could be angry, perverse, and threatening. During our first few conversations, I tried to work up the nerve to request an interview for my book, but I never knew which Manson I might end up talking to from moment to moment. I quickly learned from talking to other inmates and intuiting from Manson himself that the two most important rules for having any kind of relationship with him are, 1, never ask him for anything, and 2, never allow yourself to be dependent on him. Manson explained to me that at least 90% of the letters he receives are from people wanting something. People all over the world want his autograph and his art. Almost daily, he receives requests to fill out and sign questionnaires from students writing various papers. He gets a lot of mail from musicians. There is so much mail that one man could not possibly read half of it. Kenny told me Manson sometimes opens an envelope just to see if there are stamps inside. He couldn't care less about its other contents. He once covered an entire wall of his cell with postage stamps. Those early phone calls were amazing. I feel as if we both went through a feeling out process. Charles testing me all the way. My challenge was getting past the fixed idea of Manson with which I'd grown up, the famous, legendary face of evil. Manson, on the other hand, was struggling to determine my intentions. It became clear that the man isn't capable of trusting anyone. He inquired over and over again what my real motives were and had trouble accepting the truth, that I was interested in only communicating with someone I found fascinating. Finally, when I found the nerve to ask Manson if he'd do an interview, he seemed surprised I hadn't already tried to take his words for my own purposes. "What, you're not recording this?" he asked. I assured him I wasn't, and then, once he seemed willing to listen, I explained the concept of my book and what I wanted to accomplish. Charles thought the idea was cool. He liked philosophizing about non-duality, oneness, the deeper truths. He gave me permission to record everything and said our conversations could constitute my interview.
Well, this was a darker journey than many we've taken together, but I felt these titles not only retell a story, but give us a sense of the time and the place. It's riveting stuff. Check out all the recent titles we've previewed on my website, www.bookreportradio.com. And if you'd like to make a suggestion for an upcoming show, just drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com. You can also listen to past shows and see our station lineup. Why not tell your friends and book clubs to listen in? Thanks for sharing this time with me. I'm Elaine Charles, and I'll see you next week for the next chapter of The Book Report.